15. Major League Baseball, the Brewers were off. Cubs beat Cincinnati 5-2, and the White Sox lost to Kansas City 8-3. Tonight, now, the Brewers will host the Pirates. Cubs host Cincinnati again down at Wrigley. The White Sox play in Philadelphia. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Lovely day today, sunny and warm, a high heading 478. Overnight, partly cloudy, 30% chance of rain, and a low of 63. Tomorrow, Wednesday, cloudy and very warm. Another 30% chance of rain. Tomorrow's high, though, heading for 86. Brand new numbers are in. Here's what it looks like. Humidity is still sky high at 86%. Temperatures look like this. 63 degrees, both Racine and Kenosha. 55 degrees for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. And it is 64 up in the big city of Milwaukee. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 11 minutes after 8 o'clock, the morning show with Greg Berg is up next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to welcome back into our studios a good friend of WGTD, Jim Wardrip from Preservation Racine. And in what has come to be something of a morning show tradition, Mr. Wardrip is joining us to talk about the latest Preservation Racine tour of historic places, which is coming up this Sunday, the 25th of September, from 11:30 until 5:30 p.m. It affords you the opportunity to visit some of the most intriguing and beautiful homes in Racine, and a couple of places that are not homes, but sites of historic interest and value of one kind or another. And Jim Wardrip is here to tell us what is on this year's 41st annual tour of historic places. Jim Wardrip, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, and good morning to you. And I want to thank WGTD for your help throughout the years in helping us spread the word about this is our 41st annual tour of historic places, believe it or not.
Yeah, that's great. Before we get into the tour, just say a quick word about the mission and purpose of the organization Preservation Racine.
Well, basically, Preservation Racine is a group of folks that are interested in preserving a rich architectural heritage in Racine as well, you know, in southeastern Wisconsin, quite frankly. We have two major events that we have, and our opportunities are to let people know about the history of a lot of these structures that we have around, and also celebrating the people, celebrating the fact that we have another thing that's called the Century Buildings Award that designates and recognizes homes that are 100 years old or older in the Racine County area. Mm. And that's kind of fun also because the people, we ask them if we can use their, if we can award their house a little plaque that we give out, and they say, well, what does that mean? Well, they get to have a whole history. We do research, and so we find out things about the homes and many things that people just have no clue. And
About their own home.
Yeah, about their own home.
Yeah, that is pretty exciting.
One lady a couple of years ago had no idea that A.J. Horlick, the wedding to this one woman, happened to be in the house that they live in. And so we also want to make sure we educate through education, letting people know about the history of these homes and the structures, and do our darndest to make people aware that we can't tear buildings down that are of significant architectural value.
Very good. Well, it looks like a beautiful lineup of places that are on this year's tour. Could you just say a quick word about how the tour gets put together and sort of the nature of the overtures that are made to the owners of these homes? I mean, generally speaking, are these people that you already know, or in effect, are you kind of knocking on the door of a complete stranger and asking if their home can be part of this tour? Maybe it's a little bit of both.
It is a little bit of both, and we have people that we obviously could not be doing this if it wasn't the fact that the owners of these homes have opened the doors to let the public come in and go through their house and hear the history of the house. And we go in and we ask if they would be interested in doing it. We have people that saying, oh, not this year, but we might want to do it next year. And so it's an ongoing task. It's quite frankly, after this ends, we'll start looking for homes and structures, architectural, unique architectural structures for the following year. So it probably goes on 365. But again, we couldn't do it without the help of the people that say, let the public come into in our home and they learn about the history as well about their home. So this year we have 12 sites, which we haven't had in quite a while, and some of the sites are some of these homes are just incredible, and I love to go through these homes because you're looking at three-story homes or you're looking at ballrooms on the third floor, and you're looking at butler's quarters, and this was going on in 1890s and things like that. So it's a wonderful opportunity, and then we're going to have several buildings that are public structures that the Memorial Hall, for example, and also the a Carnegie Library, which is now the Racine Heritage Museum. And then also we have St. Luke's Barnabas Chapel, which is really, really an incredible little building tucked in on the St. Luke's Wheaton Franciscan All Saints campus, which is now called Ascension, I believe, if I read the paper right this morning.
I was glad to see, too, that beautiful and distinctive statue of the Lincolns, Mr. and Mrs. Abraham and Mary Todd Lincoln, which is on the campus of the Racine campus of Gateway Technical College. Absolutely. Is also a point of special interest. And I suppose it's one of those things where, I mean, people can just drive by and get a glance at it, but this is an opportunity to really look at it up close and for there to be somebody there to answer some questions about it.
Well, we will have Stephen Rockstedt, who is a Lincoln Scholar, will be there talking about this. You know, the there are very few, and I apologize, I don't have the number. I'm looking at maybe three or four examples of Mary Todd and Lincoln and Abraham together in a statue. And this is a very, very unique statue. And one of the reasons, and you'll hear more probably, is that Mary Todd Lincoln spent time after the assassination in Racine and walked this park many, many days.
Mm.
And had also spent some time at the old Racine College campus down in DeKalb. But yes, we will have that is a highlight. And then also we're going to have a talk about the Racine, the history of automobiles in the Racine area. And that's going to be in the Barnabas Chapel. A gentleman named Jim Mercier is going to talk about the Racine automobile manufacturers. And the first automobile created right here in Racine was in 1873 when Mr. Carhart, Reverend Carhart, designed that. But they'll talk about, he has materials and some items that, old photos and so on and so forth, about Racine's automobile manufacturers. So these are what we call talking points. We'll also have an architect and designer and a builder. We've just created the reconstruction of the porch at the Blake House down on Main Street. And that was just completed. And those two gentlemen will be there at the site also talking about the challenges to make this, to replicate this, the designs and everything, and what it takes to build something as simple as you'd think as a porch, but to make it look correct.
Right. That was noticing is one of the oldest houses on the tour, dating back to 1868.
Yes.
The little summary you have here makes it sound like we are lucky to have this building, that it came close to being demolished at one point in
absolutely,
its history.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's kind of one of our jewels that we have, and it's a state historical site as well. And so we're really kind of proud of being able to maintain and keep that standing, and it's a wonderful example of Italian architecture.
Right. With these homes, generally speaking, what are people allowed to see? I mean, I'm assuming we don't get to poke around every square inch of the place. Generally speaking, what parts of the homes are made available for people to view?
Darn near almost everything, with maybe the exception of basement or or something like that. Occasionally, there's also perhaps a private room or a library or something like that. That is the door is open, but you can't walk into the room. But in most cases, you're walking in, and you can walk around, and in the locations in the houses will be docents there talking about a specific item, whether it be there's a wonderful in the Carpenter House built in 1896. They have a third floor ballroom, but there's a skylight that goes the roof on the third floor and down through the second floor. So when the sun is shining, you can see all these windows going all the way down. And you can dance on that glass floor. I didn't take a walk over it, but there's all sorts of interesting points. And yes, it's I think the interesting thing is when they walk through the front door, they're going to see a large, if not all, of the house.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in the house listed right above that, the Richard and Sarah Minor House from 1870, so another of the oldest homes on this on this tour. Your summary talks about how this 144-year-old house, its history is shared by 15 families who have called this address home. And that really gets you thinking about how sometimes that's the case, and then in some cases a home essentially remains within the same family, or maybe just two or three. But for a house to go through 15 different families during its history, and in this particular instance, remaining so beautiful, and evidently everyone who has lived there to some extent has been careful. Taken care to preserve its, in a sense, historical character and beauty. And I suppose that's one of the things this tour also celebrates, is those kind of instances.
Well, and it's interesting to note that when you get in there, you'll hear the list of people that have been in lived in that house, and there are many of the larger, the bigger names, let's say, in Racine and Racine Industry, as a matter of fact. An interesting home also is the Emily Baker House, which is now called the Christmas House. But at one time, it was a dorm for the nurses' school at St. Luke's. And we are going to have some alums there that are going to be talking about some sordid details.
Right.
You know,
I want to be sure to take a second to ask you about the Wheeler Bull House. Mm-hmm. Because the way this is listed what you write about this makes it sound like one of the more intriguing stops on the tour.
Yes.
So explain why this is such an interesting and maybe even odd, albeit beautiful, home. What makes it so uncommon, so out of the ordinary?
Well, this is it's a shingle style home, which is very interesting. And actually, in 1903 when it merged, but there were two homes in 1869 and one in 1881 that was built in 81. These two homes were pushed together, and actually there was a smaller home on the same property, but these two homes were put together, and you'll be able to see where they were put together. This home is right directly south of the Gateway campus and overlooks the water up on the bluff on the lake, and it's on a wonderful little street, and when you take a look at it, you will see that you won't notice that the two homes were fused together. But then again, you'll hear from the docent talking about if you take a look at this, you can see how this was done and so on and so forth. The other interesting thing, the homes that we've talked about here, wanting to make sure people know this. In the past, we've had where you've driven to some sites and you've gotten out and then got back in your car again and go from there. All of these homes, these 12 sites that we have, are within walking distance. So it's in the East Park. It's in the Southside Historic District, but in the East Park, of which Gateway is located, neighborhood. So you can park your car once, and it's going to be a beautiful Sunday, and the Packers are playing the Lions, and believe me, you'll make more points taking someone to the tour of homes than the Lions will get.
And, right.
But so that's going to really be kind of neat, where you get to walk around, and you walk around the neighborhood, and you're going to hear a talk on Mary Todd Lincoln and what she did, and you're going to see a home or two that she saw, which is really kind of incredible as well.
Absolutely.
So it's and each one of those talking sites that we have also, it can be kind of fun as well if you just want to, well, let me take a break and I'm going to hear about the auto industry in Racine. And we're going to have some cars there, and a Nash is going to be there, and a Lafayette, and a couple other cars that were products of the Racine manufacturer. So we're hoping for good weather. We've made that reservation for that.
And well, the extended forecast could not be nicer. It looks like it will be sunny. It also looks like it will be very comfortable temperatures. So somebody's prayers have been heard, because it looks like it's going to be a really, really lovely day, an ideal day to take in all of these different sites. So how do people get a ticket to be part of this? Because there are tickets.
There are tickets, and can't see a home without a ticket. We have advanced ticket sales at $15, and you can go online yet until Saturday noon at preservationracine.org to pick up your advanced tickets. But if you're in the Kenosha area, Andrea's is selling them. Burlington area, Gooseberry's has them. Racine has Milliger's, Miller's Flowers, O&H, Racine Heritage Museum. And in Salem, we have a new location out there, the Hill Country Market on the corner of Highway 50 and B. And what else can I say? We have at day of the event at 11 o'clock, the ticket booths will open at the Heritage Museum, at the Blake House, and at St. Luke's Chapel and Library. Tickets will be at $18 the day of the event, and we start at 11:30 and we will end at 5:30. So that gives you enough time to walk around and see, and maybe even go back. You can go back to another house or the same house if you wanted to do that.
Sounds like a lovely, lovely time. And of course, if people want to revisit any of what we've talked about or kind of examine even closer the tour sites, you can go to the website, which is preservationracine.org. Where all of this is laid out in very, very clear fashion. Again, this 41st annual tour of historic places in Racine, all within walking distance of each other in the Southside Historic District, is happening this Sunday, the 25th of September, beginning at 11:30, ending at 5:30. But, of course, that's you do with that time frame what you like. I mean, you can start towards the end or get it done nice and early or whatever, rush through it, or take your time, take the entire 5 hours and bask in some of the most beautiful sights in the city of Racine. Jim Wardrop with Preservation Racine, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you for joining me today on the morning show, and best wishes to you and everyone involved with Preservation Racine.
Thanks so much, Greg.
It's 8:33, and part two of today's morning show is coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. We want to remind you that support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. We are going to be readdressing a figure in history who is drastically misunderstood. It is Emperor Nero, one of Rome's most famous emperors, and unjustly blamed, it would seem, for the great fire which consumed the magnificent city of Rome in the year 64. The book is The Great Fire of Rome, The Fall of the Emperor Nero and His City, and it is written by Stephen Dando Collins, with whom I spoke earlier on the morning show about a fascinating book called Tycoon's War, Vanderbilt and Walker in Nicaragua. Now, that story is a story that most of us, certainly me, had absolutely never, ever heard of. And so this, by contrast, is a very different sort of historical project in which Stephen Dando Collins is taking something that we all think we know at least a little bit about and turning it on its head, helping us understand that, in fact, the presumptions that many of us make about who Nero was and what he did and what he's guilty of do not square with the historical record at all. His book is not only a story about what most likely happened with the Great Fire of Rome, but also helps us understand how this sort of fiction around Nero sprang up in the wake of this disaster. The book is published by Da Capo. Again, it's called The Great Fire of Rome, The Fall of the Emperor Nero and His City. And Stephen Dando Collins, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. Good to be with you again.
I am so happy about this opportunity to speak with you. Are you struck as I am by the difference between these two books and kind of what each of them represents in terms of us not knowing our history as well as we should?
Yeah, very much so. This is actually my eighth book on Roman history. The ninth, in fact, is being published in the UK next month by a different publisher and on a different subject. So I've had several different historical streams running for some years now. One, as I say, has been Roman history, and the other has been American history. So the two books you mentioned are examples of both streams.
In this case, of course, we're talking about something that most people know at least a little bit about, but the little we presume to know seems to not, in fact, be correct. First of all, help us understand better than we otherwise do the importance of Rome at its heyday and what its state of affairs was at the time of the Great Fire in 64. Was it still in its heyday, or was Rome already very much in its decline?
No, you're right. It was indeed its heyday. The first century was the golden era of Rome. We are talking about Nero, the last of the Caesar family. But prior to him, we had Claudius and Caligula and Tiberius and Augustus, the first of Rome's emperors. So we're fairly early into the imperial era, and Rome is really at its zenith in terms of power and wealth. And by this stage, Britain has been invaded for 17 years and is in the Roman fold. The Roman power extends throughout the Mediterranean, right throughout the Middle East, North Africa, and it is, you know, the superpower of its age.
The story of the Emperor Nero's rise to the throne is intriguing. For no other reason than the fact that he is acclaimed emperor at the tender age of 17. I don't know that makes him the youngest of all emperors, but certainly it's a little bewildering for us to imagine the mantle of such responsibility being laid on the shoulders of someone so young.
True, but he was not unprepared. He had known for several years that he was destined to be the heir and successor of his uncle Claudius. And he had for many years as his tutor, Seneca, the famous philosopher, who schooled him very well. And so by the time he came to the throne, he was an accomplished public speaker, even if his speeches were written for him by Seneca. And he had a very good management team around him, with Seneca as his chief secretary, his running his White House, if you like, and the head of the military was a guy called Burrus, who was his secretary of defense, and they were both very able men. So he had a good team around him. He had the training. He had seen how the palace worked from the inside, the good and the bad, as he grew up. And So he was not unprepared, but as you say, it was a tender age. But let us remember that Roman men came of age at the age of 16, unlike 21 or whatever today. So they were prepared for civic life very early.
Tell us about his tremendous love for, and we presume talent, for music, and the kind of competitions which he was inclined to enter, including the one which he was competing in at the time that this fire broke out in Rome. Tell us more about Nero, the musician.
He was vilified after his death by various Roman writers who poked fun at him and said that he wasn't much of a singer. But he certainly applied himself. He trained himself as a singer. All the members of the imperial family, a lot of them didn't have much to do in the palace when they were growing up. So they took on all sorts of training. The emperor Claudius was a well-known poet and historian, and likewise with Nero, he took an interest in singing and trained his voice. Went off the sorts of food that it was thought were detrimental to the voice, like apples, and among the other things that were done to train the voice, a singer would lie on the floor and a piece of lead would be put on the chest that apparently helped their breathing and improved their singing. And he became quite an accomplished singer and longed to compete in the public singing contest. Particularly in Greece. Greece was the home of the arts, and all the major games in Greece, including the Olympic Games, excluding the Olympic Games, but all the other public games, featured singing contests, poets, heralds, and so on. And he longed to compete on stage to prove that he was the equal or even better than the other contestants. But the people around him at the palace were disinclined to let him go on the public stage. They worried that this would demean his status. And in my book, I liken him to it would be a little like an American president deciding to compete on American Idol. it was not quite done, so they very successfully convinced him to initially, if he was going to sing in public, do it at out-of-the-way venues in country towns. But he fully intended to, and later did, after the Great Fire, ended up competing in all the major contests in Greece and won them. Whether it was because he had a good voice or whether because no one dared not give him the prize, we don't really know.
Speaking of what we don't really know, of course, one of the challenges which you face and others who write about Rome is that there are conflicting accounts and often accounts which were written to make a very specific sort of political point rather than to recount exactly what happened. And certainly your book helps us to try at least to untangle that knot when it comes to as divisive a figure as Nero. Before we even talk about the fire, could you just speak a word about the historical accounts of this period and about Nero, and what one is to make of them? I mean, what use are they in trying to unlock the truth?
Well, of course, without them, we wouldn't know that there had been a great fire. Some people say, oh, we should ignore the old classical accounts because they're either biased or are incorrect, and we should only go by modern analysis. Well, there would be no modern analysis without these classical accounts, so they can't be discounted, and they have to be carefully analysed. Each author of the day had their own agenda, their own barrow to push. But the most we know about the Great Fire comes from the Roman historian Tacitus, who was a boy at the time, living in Rome at the time of the Great Fire. He was highly critical of Nero when he wrote his histories, but he was, in many respects, the most reliable of the Roman historians, because while his bias came through, he tended to the other authors who wrote about Nero, Suetonius. He wrote about the first 12 Caesars. I think if he were alive today, he'd write Pulp Fiction because his works were full of all the most scurrilous detail he could put in. And it's from him that we know so many colourful details about the likes of Caligula and Claudius and Nero. And we're not entirely sure how much of this was pure gossip and how much was fact. There were several other authors, classical authors, Cassius Dio. He wrote 150 years after the fact, and he tended to rely a lot on these earlier authors. And in fact, if you read his works about the first century, it's possible to see how he lifted whole tracts from the likes of Tacitus and put them in his own later histories. And there are several other authors, Josephus, the Jewish author who was alive at the time and living at Rome at the time of the Great Fire. He gives us some interesting detail as well. So, and there's one or two other authors that give us smaller details. We also know that people like the poet Martial was living at Rome at the time. So there are various sources, and so the job of the scholar and the author today is to take those sources and try and make sense of them. And this is what I've tried to do in this book. I was amazed, I have to say, that there's been no book written about the Great Fire of Rome as such. There have been lots of histories about Nero and this period, but no book really focused on the fire and on the political ramifications of the fire.
Hmm. I find that astonishing as well. Well, whoever or whatever was responsible for the fire in terms of what or who might have started it, it seems fairly clear that Nero was nowhere on site when the fire broke out. He was at one of these competitions, but you tell us he went back to Rome very, very quickly and oversaw efforts of relief and so on as best he could. Explain just how massive and significant this fire was in terms of how much of the city was affected and destroyed.
Fires were common in Rome. Once a decade, roughly, there would be a major fire that would wipe out an entire suburb. You can imagine the economy of Rome was totally based on the open fire, from bakeries to workshops. And it was not uncommon for fires to break out. And Rome didn't have a fire brigade as we know it today. They had troops whose job it was to try and fight fires, but with buckets of water. So the firefighting capacity was low. So it was no surprise when a fire broke out, and also there were stories that landlords, when they decided that they could make more profit by demolishing their property and then putting up the rents significantly when they rebuilt, were reputed to set fires in their own properties. So when the news first arrived, reached Nero that there was a fire at Rome, he didn't make steps to leave Antium or Anzio, as we know it today, on the west coast of Italy, where he was competing in a singing contest, as you say, because he felt, they'll bring it under control, like all the other fires, it won't be a problem. But the next report he received was that the fire is totally out of control. It started in the Circus Maximus. The wind has blown it away. It's destroyed the circus, which was the largest wooden building ever built. So you can imagine being all wood apart from the stone foundations. It burnt readily. And then the very strong wind blew it to the Aventine Hill, which was a major suburb of the elite, and then to surrounding areas. And then the wind changed and blew it back the other way, and so that it headed toward the remainder of Rome. And the fire initially burned for 5 days. And when the second report reached Nero, he realized that it was no small fire, and he told his entourage, we're heading back to the city. But when he arrived back, it was defined that um, There were hundreds of thousands of refugees had fled the city. The reports don't indicate that there was a great loss of life, so there seems to have been time for the majority of the people in the path of the fire to get out of its way. Some reports say that, you know, the elderly and the stubborn who didn't want to leave their homes were consumed by the fire. So the actual death toll wasn't all that high, but the damage was extensive. And then the fire broke out anew when they thought it was at an end. The only real firefighting measures that work were to actually level buildings, whole streets of buildings in the path of the fire. And this is what they did, and that seemed to work. And then the fire broke out anew at the base of the Capitoline Mount and swept up that hill and burned for another 2 days. So by the time the fire had finally been extinguished after a week, only 4 of the 14 precincts of Rome were totally untouched by the fire. All the central part of the city, all the ancient temples, which are hundreds of years old, all the public buildings, and Nero's own palace had all been totally destroyed. This, as I say, it's aptly called the Great Fire of Rome. It was immense.
In one of the reasons, it would seem that Nero has been blamed, unjustly blamed, for either not caring about the fire or perhaps even being a party in starting it. Some suggested it was so he could build a new palace. But one of the reasons for him attracting blame is because of the way in which he assigned blame. Explain to our listeners who he publicly blamed for the fire of Rome and what he did in terms of acting on that presumed blame.
This is probably the most controversial aspect of the entire story of the Great Fire of Rome. The only reference to this is in Tacitus, in his annals. And as I said earlier, he is generally regarded as a very reliable historian. His facts tend to add up. And he worked from the official records of the day. But in the middle of the story of the Great Fire, there's this account in the versions of his annals that will come down to us that he fixed the blame on the Christians at Rome. And he had, according to this paragraph, had a multitude arrested and then persecuted them, sent some into the arena to be devoured by the wild beasts, and burned others on crosses. But many scholars believe that this was inserted later by Christian copyists. In those days, there were no printing presses. This, you know, we were a long way before the invention of the printing press. And the way that books were produced, clerks would sit down and handwrite every book. And so you would go to the local bookstore, and here would be these rolls of parchment which had been handwritten very artfully. This was how you read your books. And so every single copy was handmade, handwritten. And so it was quite easy, as new copies were made, for someone to change the text, to insert whatever they liked. And it suggested that perhaps 100, 200 years, 300 years later, somebody inserted this reference to the Christians. Some scholars believe that this entire reference was invented. Others wonder where maybe some of it was factual, but some of the details were changed by the later writers. And it's interesting that the reasons, or the text that says the Christians were punished, if you replace the word Christians with the Egyptians, this was a title given to the followers of Isis, an Egyptian goddess, which had grown very large at Rome by this stage, but it was looked at down upon by the elite. It was mostly followed by slaves and ex-slaves. There were many thousands of followers. followers at Rome at this time. And when you read this passage in Tacitus, it talks about that to humiliate them, some were attacked by dogs in the arena, and others were burned. Now, Anubis, one of the gods associated with the followers of Isis, actually wore a dog's head, and it also said that they were covered in animal skins. And the followers of Isis eschewed animal skins. They even wore parchment sandals, so they didn't even have leather on their body. So it's possible that if Nero did in fact punish a whole group of people, a whole class of people, for setting the Great Fire of Rome, to take the blame from his own shoulders, it's far from being the Christians, it may have been these followers of Isis, if it occurred at all.
It is so intriguing to think about, in a sense, kind of the liquid nature of history, or the tenuous nature of the historical record. And, of course, one of the things that's so interesting about your book is that you are not only trying to give us, in a sense, your best judgment about some of these intriguing questions, but just by laying out kind of the messiness of these conflicting historical accounts, or the possible conflicts of interest or hidden motivations that might have led to the rewriting of history, as it were. I mean, that in and of itself is a fascinating story, even apart from the city of Rome nearly burning to the ground.
Yeah, it is indeed. And it's something for the historical writer, for the researcher, for the historian, it's something of a treasure hunt, pulling all these pieces of information together. And then and ultimately it comes down to the writer to make the decision what they believe is the most likely truth to be found there. But, history is full of many truths. Hmm. So, I challenge my readers to think and to take on board all potential arguments. So I do set out in the introduction to this book, the conflicting accounts and the different ways that they could be interpreted, and then I give my interpretation.
The book again is called The Great Fire of Rome, The Fall of the Emperor Nero and His City. The book is published by Da Capo, and its author, Stephen Dando Collins. I thank you so much for joining me today. You have written yet again a fascinating book, and I'm glad we could talk about it today on The Morning Show. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. I've enjoyed it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'll be speaking with the author and editor of a really fascinating book called Who Shot Sports? It is a look back at some of the most important sports photographers through history. And it's a history that stretches all the way back to 1842, believe it or not. It's a fascinating book, and you'll hear our conversation tomorrow. On Thursday, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, pays his monthly visit to the program, a conversation recorded with our own Dave McGrath. On Friday, I speak with best-selling novelist Jennifer Cavarini about her latest book, which is incredible. It's called Fates and Traitors, a novel of John Wilkes Booth, in which we meet John Wilkes Booth and come to understand him through the eyes of four different women who were important in his life. This is historical fiction at its very best. You'll hear my conversation with her on Friday. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com.